Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, welcome back to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I am Davida Goldberg, today's host. We'll be talking to Professor Lars Rinsmann of the University of Groningen about his new book, The Politics of Unreason, The Frankfurt School and the Origins of Anti-Semitism, which was published this year, 2017. Lars, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Davida.
So to begin today's conversation, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about who you are, your background, what eventually led you to your interest?
Sure. This is a long story, but I tried to give a short version of it. There are two tracks, really. I'm a German. I grew up in post-war Germany, really, in many ways, a second generation, between second and third generation after the Holocaust, after World War II. And so obviously there's a personal aspect to it, being confronted with dealing with processing in what was still at the time when I was young, a very, repressive climate, and notwithstanding anything that you hear about post-war Germany and the so-called world champions of coming to terms with the past, there wasn't really much space of really processing what has happened and addressing questions of perpetratorship, who was actually involved, family, relatives, Germans, ordinary Germans. All of these debates were just really much later in the 1990s, not when I was growing up. So I developed this interest in
so when you were growing up, was that the, like, the 80s? Is that,
yeah,
is the, that
the, what 80s, were? The 80s would be when I was a teenager, yeah. So I was born in 1970, and so it's been really a child of the 70s and 80s, the late decades of the Cold War, and overshadowed by all other kind of conflicts. And really during the 1980s, there was a beginning movement of young people challenging, thinking about local histories of developing and trying to find an understanding of local histories of the Holocaust. So, and a big part of that, of course, was a haunting question, a question that wasn't addressed much at all, the question of anti-Semitism. So I began becoming interested in the subject and exploring more on the question of anti-Semitism, which is why, and this is a track that has been with me, I've become a scholar of anti-Semitism, and by now I serve in various functions in that, on editorial boards and doing work on anti-Semitism, also in different contexts over the years. And this is like one trajectory of my scholarly career. And the other track that I was interested in, I'm a political theorist. I'm a political scientist, but also a political theorist. And since I was a teenager, I was young, I was left-wing, I was politicized, and I was interested in the Frankfurt School, frankly. And I read these, early on as a teenager, still going to high school, I started to read these articles and books by the Frankfurt School. So so in this sense, and I say that at the beginning of the book, is really it's been a long time coming. I've wrote many other books and did many other research projects in between, but my first book where that was actually published as a result from my master thesis in the 1990s was already on the subject of the Frankfurt School and anti-Semitism. So for me, it's a kind of, if you will, an ongoing lifetime project. And this is why probably the book also is 600 pages and not just 200.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. I have a couple of questions. Just going back, taking you back to what you've just said. First of all, what did the textbooks in high school, for example, cover in Germany in the period that you're talking about?
Not much. Not much. They really, to be honest, there's a lot of variation when you think about it. There was, first of all, in Germany, the educational system is organized in complete authority of the states. It's actually, that's a consequence of the restructuring of post-war Germany and democratization, really following the U.S. model, where educational authority is very much a matter of states, of the below the federal level. And so you see a lot of variation of how post-war, how World War II and history, and in particular the Shoah, was taught or not taught at all in different states. And then you have, of course, the variation of different schools and of different teachers. And I ask this question. I teach these days. I always teach an introductory course into European politics and society in the Netherlands. And we have a very multicultural, very cosmopolitan student body, and one session we always do is on the legacies of Auschwitz, and we have seminar sessions. We ask students, what are your experiences with being educated about the Holocaust and World War II? And there's still an enormous variation. That's what I experienced in the 1980s already. It was a huge variation. I knew that other people, in some cases, young teachers were active, challenging, and raising questions and teaching the history of the Holocaust. In other cases, not at all. And I was actually in the situation that I had a teacher, a history teacher, who almost was close to denying the Holocaust. So I was certainly not exposed to this claim that you hear once in a while in the papers, that we have this overexposure of Holocaust education. That's it's not the case today. It certainly wasn't the case then. And in my personal case, it was rather the situation that the guy was very radical right wing, my history teacher, and basically blamed Roosevelt for the war.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So that could be a good launching point into some of the meat of your book, because you mentioned in your book, and I think it's a quote from Jeffrey Isaac, mm-hmm. that thousands of pages about justice and morality have been published without mention of Auschwitz, mm-hmm. and that Auschwitz is you say that Auschwitz is a neglected legacy. Mm-hmm. And it did occur to me that many people would be surprised at that turn of phrase, having heard that Auschwitz is actually a Holocaust industry. Mm-hmm. So I wonder what insights from critical theory can help us understand that first part. Why is Auschwitz a neglected legacy? Why have we not been talking about mm-hmm. the Holocaust?
Because ultimately it's it is and it will remain an uncomfortable topic. It's an uncomfortable topic for everyone in the world. It's not easy to face this the unspeakable crimes of the Shoah. It's not easy to address a genocide. It's not pleasurable. It's not fun. And of course, it is loaded with all kinds of effective elements. And particularly, that's the case in the context, of course, of post-war German history. When we really look at it, the Holocaust, of course, since the 1980s, has recovered or has gained a sort of spotlight. And there was basically a belated processing that some authors then were very quick to almost defame as Holocaust industry, as an overdoing it, an over-memorializing. But the reality of it, these were very belated processes. There wasn't much memory or memorialization for many decades after 1945.
Survivors
didn't have the opportunity to speak up. They were kind of like, their memory was isolated, marginalized, forgotten. And no one really talked about it in the public. No one was interested in that.
Right. I think the critical theorists have coined a term that you go into in your book, secondary anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Do you think that was a part of what was going on? And can you describe what secondary anti-Semitism was?
Secondary anti-Semitism was a term by the Frankfurt School, coined in the context of really post-war Germany. And it means basically that the rejection or discrimination against Jews, not that old types of anti-Semitism had simply disappeared, but there's a new dimension to anti-Semitism. It's not secondary that it's less, in the sense that it's less forceful or it's less a powerful type of ideology or resentment, but it's secondary in the sense that it's an anti-Semitism that is driven by the rejection of dealing with the past, by the desire to glorify the national past. And it's impossible, frankly, to glorify a national past from a historical, sober historical point of view when you have when you live in a country that committed these enormous atrocities. So there's always this stain on the history, and there's also, of course, the very uncomfortable, very pressing memory of these crimes. And if you are not willing to deal with that, if you don't, you're not willing to accept these crimes, then of course you try to blame someone else for the crimes and or for bringing up the topic of the Holocaust and Auschwitz. And for a long period and still today, that's a motivation that Jews are blamed basically for bringing up the Holocaust, or in other words, to instrumentalize the Holocaust for their interests or making it a subject and basically attacking the Germans. So that's the kind of configuration. It's an anti-Semitism after Auschwitz that is an anti-Semitism that to a large extent takes its energy out of the desire to repress, reject, downplay what has happened during those dark years.
Right. So what I think I understood from your book is that it's also, we can understand the psychology of this denial even more clearly through some of the kind of Freud plus theories that the critical theorists bring into understanding the anti-Semite as a disposition, as a psychological disposition. So somebody who, for some reason, and maybe you can help us understand how these personalities get formed as well, but that the personality is prone to projecting outwards their negative emotions. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you can talk to us a little bit about what is the basis of anti-Semitism according to the critical theory school. And then we'll, just to give you a kind of preview, if you can tell us a little bit about that kind of basic fundamental definitions of anti-Semitism, we can also then dial back and talk about exactly who were the critical theorists. Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay, sounds great. Well, the first claim, or that's a crucial claim for the critical theories, and that to some extent there is a link between what we just talked about, secondary anti-Semitism and primary anti-Semitism. In both cases, there are the critical theories early on claim, starting with their studies of authoritarianism in the 1920s and then going to the 1930s and really changing and maturing their theories and their empirical work in the 1940s. They claim that there is a link between this anti-Semitic projections we began to talk about and certain social dispositions, social-psychological dispositions. So the claim is that there's a certain authoritarianism that is to some extent still present in modern society, to some extent even reinforced by modern society, that makes people more likely to actually project their insight outward to onto out-groups, and in particular here, towards Jews. So the claim is there's certain social psychological dispositions, and these dispositions are described by the critical theories, critical theorists, as the desire to conform to social rules, to blindly conform to social rules, the desire to a precondition or a condition of authoritarian aggressiveness. The disposition to project one's inner feelings rather than to reflect on them, the disposition to project sexuality and desires and problems to the outside world. And all of this kind of forms, according to critical theory, a syndrome, an authoritarian syndrome, that is not just represented in one person or a particular group, but is actually a widespread phenomenon that people are shaped by this kind of authoritarian dispositions that makes them more susceptible to all kinds of prejudices, all kinds of resentments, and in a particular way also to anti-Semitism. And one final note on that is, so when we talked about secondary anti-Semitism, this desire to not talk about the past, for many in the second, third generation, it's never about personal guilt. It's about some kind of collective guilt. It's some kind of stain on the collective, on the nation. And for critical theorists, there's a strong link between the need for this kind of collective national identity or national gratification, the gratification to be something of a stronger, bigger, larger identity and collective, that is particularly strong among people who share these authoritarian dispositions. And so there is a link between primary and secondary anti-Semitism or modern anti-Semitism and the secondary anti-Semitism in the sense that both are showing this longing for being part of a strong identity, a strong national collective, and trying to restore that strong collective. And that is some of the things, of course, that we are seeing that are going on in this day and age, when this cultural expression, the need of a strong national, a glorified national identity and collective, has become resurging and become more powerful in the globalized world again.
Yeah, I think later on, I'm hoping to get to the question of what is that relationship between modernity and what they call the post-liberal personality and anti-Semitism and ongoing anti-Semitism. But for right now, one of the as I'm listening to, I just want to confirm my understanding of what you're saying, which is that the authoritarian syndrome is both a personality type. And it is reinforced by some kind of social arrangement, social structures. So the two things are going together. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's exactly right. So as this often is with the Frankfurt School, which is a very kind of course, complex, philosophically informed type of thinking, very much adapted to theorems, ideas from Karl Marx, from Sigmund Freud, from Max Weber, even Nietzsche and others, Kant and Hegel, of course. So it's a complex, sophisticated philosophical framework that goes into an interdisciplinary framework of understanding, exploring issues of anti-Semitism. So when we look at that, for the critical theorists, it is the focus on examining empirically at the time already, these kind of, and at the time certainly groundbreaking research on authoritarian dispositions. They call it the F scale, fascism scale, in the 1940s.
Right. So you're referring to some of the empirical studies that they did in the 40s. Can we start talking first of all about those early 30s? Because I do find it really surprising and intriguing that they had this interdisciplinary institute set up where they were doing psychology and social theory and empirical studies and theorizing. And I wonder if you can tell us about the genesis of the Institute and who were the main players and just start at the beginning, since we started kind of at the end there with the modern situation, start back at the beginning and tell me an intro to this field.
Absolutely. The Frankfurt School is really identified only later on with Frankfurt because its origins were in Frankfurt. So it's been a whole group of scholars at the time in the 1920s in the Weimar Republic in Frankfurt who got together at the University of Frankfurt and around the University of Frankfurt to found this institute of an interdisciplinary study. This already was groundbreaking at the time. And all of them initially inspired by some kind of unorthodox Marxism, by some kind of left-wing Marxist background. And the main theorists, the main thinkers, the main researchers that identified with the Frankfurt School and that ultimately formed the core were Theodor W. Adorno, Leo Löwenthal, whom I had the pleasure to meet when in 1992, half a year before he passed away in Berkeley. Herbert Marcuse, very influential in the New Left, also in America, both in Germany and America, in fact, and Max Horkheimer. And Max Horkheimer and Theodor W. Adorno eventually, all of them migrated to the U.S., reestablished the institute that they had helped to found in the 1920s and early 30s, and emigrated to the U.S., reestablished the institute affiliated with Columbia University in the 1940s, and eventually Horkheimer and Adorno moved back to Frankfurt, whereas Löwenthal and Marcuse stayed in the U.S. Marcuse with various positions, including years at Brandeis and San Diego, and Löwenthal as a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley.
Okay, right. So how can you explain to me, how is it that they came up with this idea of an interdisciplinary institute?
Oh, that's a complex story. There's a different trajectories. They thought that in many ways, they made a distinction very early on that evolved to an essay of my Max Horkheimer in the 1930s called Traditional and Critical Theory. They had started research project in the 1920s to, they just basically realized that a lot of social phenomenon and problems could not be understood, and that was the kind of beginning of this in a purely strictly disciplinary framework. So in many ways they were sociologists, philosophers. They themselves had different types of trainings. So Adorno, for example, started out clearly as a philosopher who then later on became a sociologist and actually was trained in sociological research and became realized, and soon the critical theorists, when their own studies, and when they started them, they were not so interested in political psychology. But one other name I forgot to mention, who was very instrumental at the beginning of the school, was Erich Fromm, who was very much interested in psychology. So the different fields came together from the start. They were different scholars with different training, and all of them shared the idea that, well, there are limitations to our individual training in the individual school. And of course, in a way, the Marx assumption or the Marxist starting point helped in that, because Marx himself, of course, is by its very nature an interdisciplinary thinker, a philosopher, an economist, if you will,
a
sociologist.
He visited factories and talked to people, and not didn't just sit at his desk. But it's interesting because you mentioned in the book that that a lot of readers of critical theory don't really believe that the empirical work had that much validity or that much impact on the theory. Mm-hmm. And yet, you also tell the tale of Horkheimer's conversion in his theories of anti-Semitism from an early 30s essay, I believe, where he considers anti-Semitism, as you say, as, quote, an epiphenomenon of secondary relevance mm-hmm. to the problem of labor and capitalism. Mm-hmm. And that anti-Semitism, I think, as far as Horkheimer was concerned in that early work, was just a cynical capitalist strategy of the elite that was being used against workers to distract them, or maybe it was a purely reflexive reaction to economic crisis, which is how you put it, that the workers were just reacting to crises that, and the anti-Semitism itself was not really the issue. And yet it was the empirical studies, as far as I can understand from what you've written, that helped them change their mind even early in the 1930s. Is that the case? And can you explain what that interplay was?
Yes, I think that's a very good summary of some of the arguments. One of the major arguments I make in the book is really that the experience of the Holocaust, the experience of doing their studies in exile, the experience of anti-Semitism transformed critical theory. And what you referred to with the case of Max Horkheimer, this might be the most, on the one hand, the most drastic example of this change, Max Horkheimer, and also exemplifying this transformation. As you said, Max Horkheimer had published an essay in the 1930s, when there were already other studies by Erich Fromm and others pointing to the direction that authoritarianism, anti-Semitism, the psychological dimension is very important. Horkheimer at the time still didn't really buy into that, was very much working in this Marxist framework where critical theory at large started, and this Marxist, the early Marx, one should say, understanding that driven by a philosophy of history, that there are these two classes clashing, and it basically the bourgeoisie or the ruling class uses stereotypes, anti-Semitism, prejudices, resentments to simply deflect from its crisis and from the oppression it exercises. A very classical Marxist interpretation that is still prevalent in Horkheimer's writing in the 1930s. Now, what happens here is for some of the critical theorists, even Adorno, anti-Semitism and the Holocaust, later on that as it evolves, initially, when they were in exile, they didn't fully grasp the full nature of it. Hannah Arendt said in an interview she only fully knew what was happening in Auschwitz by 1943. In these early years, this transformation between the 1930s and 1940s took place, and all of these scholars, including Adorno and Horkheimer most prominently, started to recognize the relevance of anti-Semitism, the relevance and the power of political psychology, and the misguidedness, so to speak, of this classical Marxist way of thinking about this challenge. And not only that, Horkheimer fully transformed his thinking. And the first expression of that is then the Dialectic of Enlightenment, the first major book that stands for, represents critical theory of the Frankfurt School type. And it contains that what I would still call probably the most important contribution to a theory of anti-Semitism, of modern anti-Semitism, the so-called elements of anti-Semitism, a chapter in the book that initially was designed to be very central to the book. And then it basically was relegated to a late a section and no longer had the centrality. And in the reception of the Dialectic of Enlightenment, that is also interesting, it really was almost marginal. When you read about books, the canonic reflections of the Frankfurt School, the Dialectic of Enlightenment is always mentioned. Very, very few address the chapter of elements of anti-Semitism. While I make the case, it is central in more ways than one. It's central because it really transformed the confrontation with anti-Semitism, this multifaceted problem, challenge, what the critical theorists call the social injustice of our time. That's the way they put it. Becomes the central focus of trying to understand what is going on in modern civilization, that such a barbaric regression, that such a catastrophe could be possible in the modern age. So they raise this question in light of anti-Semitism, in light of the Holocaust. And this is what really drives this transformation of critical theory with all kinds of implications, which a new thinking about modern society using different sociological and other sources, but really taking the challenge seriously to confront and try to process what the hell was going on with this nightmare into this darkness and the atrocities that happened in the 20th century. And anti-Semitism for them at that point is a central dimension and aspect to it. And in post-war history, not just generally, this dimension was neglected and hardly discussed, but also in the reception of critical theory, it was hardly discussed, as this the career of that chapter shows, that only recently has become, has received a broader discussion again. And it was always marginalized. And my point is really, this is central to understanding why critical theory, the Frankfurt School critical theory that we know, evolved, why it transformed, why it became this Frankfurt School theory in the 1940s. And my claim is also, as you pointed out, that this was a reflection of the real-time events unfolding in Nazi Germany and in Europe with the extermination of the Jews of Europe, and their own particular empirical studies, which they conducted in the US and America, the empirical studies on authoritarian dispositions and anti-Semitic ideology, and also anti-Semitic agitators and anti-Semitic demagoguery taking place in America at the time.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like what they found out is that rather than anti-Semitism being just the strategy, for example, and I hear this even today sometimes, say that it was the strategy that Hitler used to kind of rally people and foment a certain kind of emotion, but it wasn't really the point. The point was something else. The point was economic oppression or economic dominance. And yet what they seem to have found and is that, in fact, anti-Semitism was a central telos of Nazism. Mm-hmm. And it was not ancillary. It was not just a strategy.
Right.
So, and that seems to have been, in a way, a surprise for them. But what kind of is a consistent theme of theirs is the theorizing about modernity. And when you read the Dialectics of Enlightenment, it does seem often like a screed against modernity. And I think in your book, you take some time to explain that they're not anti-modern in a knee-jerk way. And in fact, they're looking at anti-Semitism and diagnosing it as a condition of anti-modern modernism in a way, or you write a comprehensive, total anti-modern modern world explanation. So how is anti-Semitism part of a kind of just general human condition, and how is it different within the conditions of modernity?
Mm-hmm. Well, they wouldn't say, they would say, like, as basically driven by this idea that there's a historical process, they would say, like, we cannot really say something about a general human condition. They would argue, indeed, just as you said, that there's something about modernity that enables anti-Semitism, but they're clearly not anti-modern thinkers. So let me try to unfold this argument a bit. The general premise that I make, and I start out is to make this clear in the introduction already, and it goes through this book, that yes, there's this misguided interpretation of some even canonic receptions of critical theory to make them these general critics of modernity. Even the second generation of the Frankfurt School, so to speak, Jürgen Habermas, has this kind of understanding that this was a negative view of modernity. And there are isolated sentences, even the Dialectic of Enlightenment and later on, that seem to support that kind of that narrative. That the critical theorists are anti-modern. There's a sentence, for example, in the first chapter of the Dialectic of Enlightenment, where Horkheim and Adorno state, Enlightenment is totalitarian. Now, this claim, this sentence, is of course just within, if you isolate it, it sounds horrible or very problematic. But these are dialectical thinkers. So just a page later, of course, this statement is retracted, relativized. So, and the whole point of the book and the whole point of critical theory is not to be anti-Enlightenment and or to be anti-modern, but actually they say right and clear from the start that there is no alternative to Enlightenment, but we actually have to self-reflect on those things that are going wrong in modernity. So if you will, you have to, rather than abandoning Enlightenment, you have to enlighten the Enlightenment or enlighten modernity about its conditions. And the conditions, and now I want to turn to, of modernity, where modernity is following blind patterns, where it's still somehow trapped into problems of human society that human society has not really overcome. And for them, these are patterns of where domination is blind, where basically domination, social domination, is reproduced without thinking why we're actually doing it. Hierarchies are blind or unreflective. The mastery of a nature, as we now cloak it in terms of economic growth, economic progress, are blindly reproduced and becomes, as they would say, an end of it in itself, an end in itself to produce economic growth, for example, an end in itself to make profits in a company without reflecting, does that serve human needs? Does this fulfill human needs? Does this advance a human society? So they do see a link between wherever social domination is blindly reproduced, unreflectively reproduced, there is actually a path into direct forms of social domination. Blind social domination is a problem, and it's a problem that is still with us in the 20th century, and it just takes a different form under modern conditions, the form of modern capitalism, the form of modern bureaucratic state apparatuses, where social and economic imperatives are pressing human beings to do things, to be concerned and reproducing their lives, and without reflecting of what they're actually doing and how far they actually help an ongoing process of social domination to continue. So that's right, some of the general critique of modernity. But that, again, is not understood as an anti-modern critique. It's a reflection on the modern conditions that help produce isolated individuals' authoritarian dispositions rather than overcoming them. And modernity at the very same time for the critical theorists provide the conditions to overcome that. We have the technological and the social conditions and possibilities to have a much more free and emancipated life. And for the critical theorists, that is not happening because the social order actually suffocates many of our freedoms due to social imperatives and social pressures.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, the anti-Semitism is particularly modern because modernity creates the condition of that dominating blindness or create.
Well, yes, of course, there's more aspects to this argument. This is just one thing. And actually, another claim that I want to make is when they theorize anti-Semitism, the critical theorists, there is not the one key, the one explanation, the one theoretical model, but there are lots of trajectories and reflections of aspects that actually help engender modern anti-Semitism. So for the critical theorists, there's anti-Semitism that is not only modern. There's a whole history of religious anti-Semitism they talk about, Christian anti-Semitism, other forms of religious anti-Semitism. There's other forms of group prejudices and resentments that are much older than a modern society. So modern society cannot be the explanation for anti-Semitism. And same is true for racism, by the way. You know, there racism cannot just be a reflection of particular modern conditions. However, what happens is that modern anti-Semitism becomes so powerful to some extent, particularly powerful in under conditions of modernity, they will say, and under, of course, in variations in different political cultures where it had more or less relevance, but it becomes partly so powerful because of the complexities of modern societies that are overwhelming to many people. And anti-Semitism, using contingent historical prejudices and narratives, is providing a modern world explanation. So modern anti-Semitism really, as a powerful political force, emerges in the 19th century to some extent as a reflection of the problems, contradictions, and complexities of modern society, to some extent also as a reflection of the fact that Jews, as part of modern society, were equipped just as others with equal rights. Minorities were equipped with equal rights, and also Jews were equipped more with equal rights. Now, particularly in the German case, these equal rights were only granted for a limited amount of time, and they were deprived again under the swell of anti-Semitic resentment and propaganda and social attitudes. So, but the one of the claims here is really that anti-Semitism, modern anti-Semitism, also different from racism, provides something else. It's not just a discrimination of Jews as a minority, as there we'll see in colonial racism. It's not just a reproduction of patterns of discrimination. It is that too, and it absorbs older forms of discrimination. But modern anti-Semitism emerges in a very complex and very often a deeply torn modern societies, particularly of the first half of the 20th century, as a powerful world explanation, and it serves this this purpose as a conspiracy theory that basically personifies and identifies who is allegedly responsible for all that is wrong with modern society, for all the isolation and all the crises from unemployment to psychological distress, from the pressure of modern social imperatives. The modern anti-Semitism provides this objectified, this reified, world explanation of all these phenomena. And it absorbs, in doing so, it absorbs older forms of prejudice and resentments. For example, resentments against Jews as salesmen, as bankers, as middlemen, or those professions into which Jews were locked into for a long time since the Middle Ages, because they were restricted in purchasing land, for example. And so it has to do with contingent factors that becomes then actually are used into an anti-Semitic modern ideology. And that's one of the trajectories, theoretical trajectories, critical theory provides.
Yeah, that's a great answer to my question, because it also answers the question, why the Jews? You know, curious to know if the critical theory responds to that question, then that makes a lot of sense, that they are harnessing a lot of prejudices which relate to the anti-modern feeling that they have, and it's also a release valve for, and that gets back to the way that the critical theorists are using psychological dispositions and emotions to explain these social events, that these things are release valves for frustrations and also projecting one's own dissatisfaction and self-hatred onto another. So I think what you've kind of, in your book, you go over this very well in one of your late chapters, the difference between racism and anti-Semitism, or the differences and similarities. And so I recommend that chapter highly, because it's very clarifying about what is the nature of anti-Semitism versus other forms of hatred, and what are the real function, psychological and social function of anti-Semitism. And what I've gotten out of it is that really it's essentially anti-modern. And that's pretty interesting coming from the critical theory school. So one of the first questions I was going to ask you is just to explain your title. Why is this a matter of unreason? And I think we've gone over this, but it might be interesting to just just pinpoint this term unreason. What is unreasonable about anti-Semitism and versus, you know, maybe some of the things that people might think are rational reasons to be, or maybe something like the early Horkheimer's explanations, which are kind of rationalist explanations.
Yeah, very good question, a very good point. Clearly, with the politics of unreason, I want to, it's like an explanation mark of my interpretation or reinterpretation of critical theory and their work on anti-Semitism here, to clearly say, in fact, the Frankfurt School is not anti-modern, it's not anti-Enlightenment, it's not this kind of critics of modernity and it's critics of reason, but self-reflection of reason. And that is what's needed, the self-reflection of rationalities that dominate modern life, and but ultimately a critique of unreason. And anti-Semitism is part of, there are other forms as well, of a politics of unreason that advances what Leo Löwenthal has called psychoanalysis in reverse, meaning that it's not about enlightening yourself about your unconscious desires or misperceptions that all of us have in the social world, but actually reinforcing those, reinforcing irrationalities, reinforcing blind sentiments and resentments. And what the critical theory have shown is that there are also political forces that employ this irrationality, and they certainly do it until this day. So it's an explanation, it's an exclamation mark of sorts to say we are talking, and the critical theorists are criticizing truly politics of unreason. They're not critics of reason. They're actually criticizing politics of unreason, that occur all the time. In our post-factual world today, where facts are simply dismissed or where rationality or reason plays no role whatsoever. And the critical theorist would be the first to criticize this as a matter of blindness and less of lack of reflection. So when they criticize certain rationalities in modern society that makes people susceptible to irrationalities, or rationalities that themselves are seen by the critical theorists are irrational to in its core, for example, the irrationality to not make humans the end of our purposes, but actually things like the orientation towards profit, those things need to be reflected. And that's a major argument they make. So politics of unreason really points to if you will, in modernity, the backlash. And the backlash for the critical theorists is, of course, to some extent built in. It's to some extent part of modernity that there are forces that blindly rebel. They call it an authoritarian rebellion, many of these movements, including the fascist movements at the time. An authoritarian rebellion, a blind rebellion against those things in political modernity that people feel unhappy with or make them unhappy, or what Max Weber has called the iron cage of bureaucracy and the patterns of modern societies. So their claim is really, if you want to understand the rise of modern anti-Semitism, there's a dialectic at play here. That on the one hand, anti-Semitism is a modern ideology. It's not about the Jews, really. It absorbs resentments, older resentments, contingent resentments against Jews, but it's not about the Jews. In fact, as I say in the book, and as the critical theorists would agree, and they do so in many junctures and of their writing, anti-Semitism works very well in the presence of Jews, but it works even better when there are no Jews. Mm-hmm. And easily you can actually transfer this. This also happens, you know, is you can apply to other minorities. It works very well if there are minorities, other minorities, but discrimination and hate speech works best if there are none. And you can just simply apply it. In the case of anti-Semitism, it's particularly extreme because Jews are no visible minorities. So the projection mechanism, the conspiracy theorists, theories that are at play in modern times and that see a big resurgence these days, work easily because you can always, only the anti-Semite knows who the actual Jews are and how the Jews are actually active, allegedly, behind the scenes to fabricate, to maneuver the world, to guide the world, and to turn society into simply puppets. So that's a particular dimension.
Yeah, it seems like it has a lot to do with a tendency to conspiratorial ideas, mm-hmm. Which relates, you know, to the first Nazi laws, which were against miscegenation and mixing. So, I take it because you know, in that case, there could be people who pass as Germans, and it's that mm-hmm. secret cabal of passers that kind of ignites the conspiratorial imagination.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And as you know, conspiracies of that scale, as part of mass politics, and now these days again prevalent on social media, are a very particular modern phenomenon. That not that there weren't conspiracies or conspiracy myths before, but that they became a political force, just like anti-Semitism is a very modern phenomenon. And I always say, once you're in the 19th and 20th century, once you're talking about conspiracies, for example, as the truthers have it with 9/11, these conspiracies that there's some dark, sinister forces basically governing the world and are responsible for wars or any kind of other major conspiracy myths, it's always just a tiny step towards anti-Semitism, towards blaming the Jews. And very often this connection is made within a text. Once you read something about a conspiracy myth, it's very close from the conspiracy to anti-Semitism. And that, of course, has historical reasons, because not because of what Jews were doing or that Jews were conspiring, but simply because these myths have over time evolved and been identified by agents, by actors with Jews. And so the desire to actually explain the world, the desire to follow an conspiracy theory that personifies all social problems and also even psychological problems, then falls, because of these anti-Semitic modern ideologies, onto the Jews, and it just becomes reproduced time and again. And activated again. And one example of that is, I have to say, without being explicitly talking about the Jews, and that's another insight of the many insights that the Frankfurt School provides in analyzing anti-Semitism and modern Judeophobia, is that anti-Semitism, particularly in democratic societies, and they observed that already in the 1940s, works very well with innuendo, with illusions, without blaming directly the Jews and talking about the Jews do this, the Jews do that. It's allusions to an establishment and images that all of a sudden this establishment is portrayed only or primarily with Jews. And I have to say one case of that, one instance of that, one instantiation of that is the final campaign ad that President Donald Trump presented to the American public, where he 6 times in this 2-minute campaign ad blames the establishment and then shows George Soros, shows all kinds of world leaders allegedly planning a sinister profit-seeking conspiracy against the American people. And once again, the Jews are not mentioned there explicitly, but of course, the connotations and the ideas of a conspiracy against the American people, and then even showing explicitly Jewish a Jewish investor and Jewish economists and Jewish Jews, that of course can mobilize without ever being overtly anti-Semitic. And as it works today, very often people look for, they would never declare themselves, I'm an anti-Semite, as they would never say, I'm a racist. But to some extent, there is a need or there's a mobilization of an anti-Semitism without being called anti-Semite or without with the legitimacy of like, no, you're actually, when you hate the Jews, or when you act like the Jews, you're actually not anti-Semitic, or when you discriminate against blacks or other minorities, you're actually not racist. So there's a need for being or for harboring these resentments without being identified or without feeling that one is an anti-Semite or a racist.
And there are mechanisms, rhetorical mechanisms for this kind of dog whistle now. Yeah. I wanted to know, as one of my very last questions, because we're running out of time here, since we started the conversation talking about how Germany was talking about the Holocaust in the 80s and 90s, I'm curious to know what the reception of your book is when you go and talk in universities in Cologne, or you mentioned that you spoke at the European Commission recently about Arendt. So what kind of feedback do you get about these theories of anti-Semitism?
Maybe just back just one second more to the previous question or what you said before, the mechanism. That's one of the chapters of the book, the 7th chapter, where I lay heavy emphasis on that the critical theorists are not just these theoretical analysts, they're actually also very political and intervening political thinkers. And in the 7th chapter, I show how much, how important politics is for them, and the reflection that actually political conditions, is there a legal state, is there a political climate that makes anti-Semitism more popular or acceptable or not so much, how important this is and how important political mobilizations of anti-Semitism are. So they really show, and I try to show this in the 7th chapter, the analysis they provided of the specific mechanisms and conditions in the political world that enable anti-Semitism, and the mechanisms, the repertoire of mechanisms that hate speech in general and anti-Semitism employs. So that's something that I would like to emphasize, as this, I think, is an important contribution also of the book that has been for a long time overlooked. Now, my experience with these talks, I receive a lot of invitations, obviously, particularly in the German context. I, even though I've never been a professor in Germany. I've taught in the US, in Italy, in the Netherlands, where I'm now. I have presented, of course, on the subject before, as I've worked on this in many, many occasions. And so I always had a sometimes controversial, but largely a positive reception, because in Germany, particularly also among the more philosophically and theoretically interested students and scholars, there are quite a few. There's quite a group of people, or many, who are interested in the subject, in both sides of the subject, on critical theory, the Frankfurt School, and the study of anti-Semitism. So there's to some extent a favorable climate. I also have to say that, however, neither the Frankfurt School nor studies of anti-Semitism are very much institutionalized in Europe or in Germany. So there's a lot of demand among students. There are many students who are interested in the subject. There's an enormous interest in the younger generations, just as we've seen even 20 years ago with the Goldhagen debate. The younger generations continuously keep asking questions, many of them. And many are interested in exploring these subjects, exploring these theories, exploring these understandings. But on the institutional level, there's a very limited space. There's very limited space for scholarship on anti-Semitism. It's largely relegated to history. There is some, though not very strong, Holocaust studies that is institutionalized in Germany and in Europe, but there's very little now left also of working through classical Frankfurt School work. The Frankfurt School, which had its heyday, so to speak, its presence in the universities in Germany after Horkheimer and Adorno in the 70s and 80s, basically has no institutional presence anymore at all. So there's a kind of disjuncture between the younger audiences, where many show a strong interest in these kind of works, and the lack of institutionalization, so to speak.
Yeah, if we had more time, we could talk probably about what might be the dispositional reasons that the institutes are not making space for what is demanded. Since we're running out of time, I wanted to ask you our traditional last question. I really enjoyed your book, first of all, and I thought it was actually a very good introduction to critical theory, although I know that's not its raison d'etre, but it was very clarifying about what some of the major and important insights of critical theory are, and it was a very enlightening analysis of the nature of anti-Semitism and the insights that the critical theorists had towards it. And I'm wondering what is next, what project is next? Is there something, you actually wrote a book that doesn't sound very related about sports more recently. So I'm wondering, do you have a next project on the go, and is it related, and what's your future?
One of the implicit legacies probably of the Frankfurt, my continuous interest in the Frankfurt School, is probably that I've always could not contain myself to just focus on one subject or one problem. So yes, I ventured out and wrote a couple of books on global politics and sports. I work continuously on European politics, but ultimately these fields or the questions are related. They're a little bit interdisciplinary. I'm also working at an interdisciplinary department right now of European studies. But my current project actually, to some extent, overlaps two interests. I just published a special issue on populism and the remaking of liberal/illiberal democracy for a journal, and one of my next projects is actually to use the critical theories work, to use the Frankfurt School's work for a critical theory of populism book, and that's a book I'm working on. And I'm also working on a book on for a longer time that is almost ready on Hannah Arendt and Adorno and their relevance for understanding global politics. So there are two kind of critical theory Frankfurt School trajectories that are ongoing, to some extent following up to the politics of On Reason. And to some extent, continuing the conversation between the relevance of these 20th century thinkers for understanding political phenomena today, as I'm interested in empirical politics and I'm interested in the problem of populism that I've worked on also for 10, 15 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think a lot of people in politics are just now coming to the topic of populism. It's clear now that it's a very important and a relevant and timely topic. So I'm really looking forward to seeing those publications come out. So I want to just thank you for being on our show. We've been talking to Lars Runsman of the University of Groningen about his new book, The Politics of Unreason, The Frankfurt School and the Origins of Antisemitism, which was published by SUNY Press this year, 2017. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Davida, for having me, and I very much enjoyed the conversation.
I did too. Thanks.